Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Tuesday of this week marked the 50th anniversary of the launch of the first manned mission to the moon. Apollo 11 took off from the Kennedy Space Flight Center on July 16, 1969. It is not an exaggeration to say that this was a moment like no other in human history as the Saturn V rocket thundered into the heavens, catapulting a tiny capsule toward Earth's moon. But nothing could compare with the excitement of the touchdown on the lunar surface on Saturday, July 20th, 1969. Those not alive to witness that event on television cannot comprehend the thrill of that moment. They cannot understand how, as the world waited and watched and listened to Mission Control communicating about all the maneuvers that landing entailed with Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin, we were all as one. People were spellbound as human beings did what had never been done before, land on the moon. And we didn't breathe until CBS TV's Walter Cronkite did.
Contact light. Okay, engine stop. APA at a descent. Auto control, both auto descent, engine command override off. Engine arm off.
We're home.
413 is in.
Man on the moon.
We copy you down, Eagle.
Listen,
Oh, jeez.
Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
As glorious as that moment was, the decision to put men on the moon, as well as the manned space program in general, did not transcend politics. Then, as now, people questioned the program. Why should we go there? Why go there time and time again? What did we get out of it? Was it worth it? I think Dr. Roger Lonius can answer those questions, and that's why we invited him to be here on this 50th anniversary week of one of man's greatest accomplishments. Dr. Lonius is former NASA chief historian, former associate director of the Smithsonian's National Air and Space Museum, and the author of Apollo's Legacy, Perspectives on the Moon Landings, and he joins us now by phone. Thank you for being with us.
Hey, my pleasure. Glad to be here.
For those of us who were alive at that time, and I had just graduated from high school, we all remember how we felt as we witnessed this historic event. I asked you before we went on the air where you were, and you didn't see it, which fascinates me. You were out with friends, and you heard it on the radio, on the car radio. But still, what were you thinking? How did you feel? What were you feeling in that moment?
Oh, it was truly exciting. I mean, I was, I'm a child of Apollo. I followed this program from the very early Mercury days up through the moon landings. And, I remember, as all of us do, we're of this age, how we would they would roll televisions into the lunchroom and take us all in there so we could watch the launches live and so forth. And that was a really big, cool thing. It sort of permeated our culture as sort of we're paying attention. And I also, as a kid, realized I could write letters to NASA and they would send me things back, like photographs and booklets about the moon landings that were being pursued and those things. So it was a truly fun time in terms of experiencing it, and we all sort of watched it with some excitement, although I was out with some friends that night and did not see the first moonwalk live. Did see it very quickly thereafter as it got replayed over and over again.
How can that be? Given what you went on to do and what you've gone on to accomplish, how did you miss the first moonwalk? How is that possible?
I think back on that, and I honestly don't know.
Did you miss Michael Jackson's first moonwalk?
It's a little bit like, the journalists who were at the Giants win the pennant. The Giants win the pennant with a walk-off home run in the early 50s. And one of the people who covered it said, "I didn't see it. I had to go out and talk to somebody real quick, and I come back in, and everybody's screaming and hollering because of this exciting event. It's not something I'm most proud of today.
Right. Well, that feat, as I said, 50 years ago, people who weren't alive really have difficulty comprehending what it felt like, and it wasn't just the thrill of the moment and watching a guy step onto the surface of the moon for the very first time in human history. It was also the whole zeitgeist of the moment in our society, in our world culture, because this happened, this was witnessed around the world. I remember the hope and the wonder and the inspiration that landing inspired. It was more than just a scientific achievement. So I have to ask, what happened? I mean, we went to the moon more than once, and then we stopped, and NASA just seemed to struggle to find its purpose. Why?
Well, I mean, the reality is the decision to go to the moon was a political decision, and it was really done in the context of the global Cold War environment that really was heating up and pretty serious in the early 1960s. And we felt we had to demonstrate this scientific and technical prowess because the future is going to be defined by the people who can advance science and technology. We knew that then. We know it now. And we felt that we had to demonstrate that because the Soviets, with a competing economic and political system, who were engaged with us in this struggle for primacy in the world, and this is going to be the dominant feature of who's going to win and who's going to lose. But by the latter part of the 1960s, by the time that we successfully reached the moon landing, the dynamic had shifted. We were now viewed as the science and technology leader of the world, unquestionably, and we didn't feel we needed to demonstrate once again what that meant in terms of space.
So let me back up a little bit, because they beat us in the Russians, the Soviet Union beat us into space in 1957 with the Sputnik satellite, which really caught America's attention and raised all kinds of alarm bells, set them ringing. And then they put the first man into space, Yuri Gagarin, not too long after that, about a month before we put, Alan Shepard, into space. Did we view that with alarm because they were beating us at science and technology, or did we fear the weaponization of space?
A little of both. This struggle, and it's hard for people who don't, those who are younger, who don't remember the Cold
Right.
War and how serious it was, for them to really grasp what this meant. I mean, we fully believed we could be nuked at any moment, and when I was a kid, we would crawl under our desks in duck and cover exercises like that would protect us from a nuclear blast. I thought that was a little silly when I was 10. But but nonetheless, this genuine concern, and the Russians had the same concern. I mean, there was this fear on their side as well that we were going to do it to them. And this animosity between these two systems really did make it so that this competition was real. And there's a speech by Lyndon Johnson right after Sputnik in which he says, you know, it took the Soviet Union 4 years to catch up to us and to build their first atomic bomb. It took them only a year to catch up to us and build their first hydrogen bomb. And now they are ahead of us. Mm. And the ability to send a satellite into orbit over our heads, in his sense, meant that they could bring a nuclear weapon down on our heads. And that was a real fear.
So that is all prelude to John Kennedy making his famous speech announcing the goal of putting a man on the moon by the end of the decade of the 1960s. And he did that before a joint session of Congress in May of 1961. Did he come up with that idea to put a man on the moon by the end of the decade by himself? Was his announcement or his decision alone? Was it a surprise to Congress or to NASA?
It was certainly a surprise to some in NASA. But he didn't make that decision alone. Right after and there's two events that take place within a week of each other in April of 1961. The first is the Yuri Gagarin launch on the 12th of April. And unbeknownst to even the Soviets, the world's response to that was really striking. Yuri Gagarin becomes this face of the Soviet Union, this new modern era leading us into space and the high technology of space exploration, and he became a world figure. Within a week of that, the American CIA, which had backed a Cuban invasion of Castro to overthrow Castro in Cuba, failed at the Bay of Pigs. And Kennedy took a real black eye because his government was supporting this. And those two events sparked him to say, essentially, I have to change the subject. What are we going to do to sort of recapture our authority and dignity in this? And he, at that point, hit upon, obviously aided by advisors, to say, what can we do in space? And he sends a brilliant memo to Lyndon Johnson, his vice president, and says, so what can we do to beat the Russians? Can we do something by putting up a space station? Can we do it by sending a probe around the moon? Can we do it in some other way? Can we do it by landing on the moon? What can we do in which dramatic results will accrue and we could actually win? So they had to So what they needed to do was to set an agenda that was far enough into the future, the end of the decade, if you will,
so that
they could be successful.
That speech in which he announced this potential moon landing is described by many as the most elegant case ever made for America's space program.
The exploration of space will go ahead, whether we join in it or not. And it is one of the great adventures of all time, and no nation which expects to be the leader of other nations can expect to stay behind in this race for space. Those who came before us made certain that this country rode the first waves of the Industrial Revolution, the first waves of modern invention, and the first wave of nuclear power. And this generation does not intend to founder in the backwash of the coming age of space. We mean to be a part of it. We mean to lead it.
That actually may be a speech other than one to Congress. I think that's an additional speech, I think. But
that's the Rice University speech in 1962, and that's a very eloquent statement of what we're doing and why we're doing it.
And he was speaking to a nation, but he was also speaking to politicians in Congress. He's a Democratic president. He had a Democratic majority in both houses of Congress. He was also speaking to a World War II generation who thought America could do anything. I think that the moon landing proved that that was a right theory. Did he have Congress on his side, or did they need to be convinced? Did he have the public on his side, or were they just as surprised as some people at NASA and wondering why?
Well, he certainly had Congress on his side, and part of the process of coming to the decision to go to the moon was Lyndon Johnson, who had been a master of the Senate for many, many years and certainly understood legislative politics truly better than just about anybody else, went over to Congress and worked through all of the leadership there and gained their support. And it was a bipartisan effort in that sense. I mean, he talked to, obviously, the Democrats, but also the Republicans who were potentially supportive as well, and lined them up to provide the votes necessary to increase the NASA budget and to carry out this particular mission. But Kennedy himself, after the speech, was not sure that Congress would go along with that. In fact, on the way back to the White House, he is in the car with Ted Sorensen, who is his chief speechwriter.
And let me stop you there, because I have to take a break. That's a real cliffhanger. We'll come back and get the rest of the story in a moment with Dr. Roger Lanius. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. It's the 50th anniversary week of the first landing of man on the moon, the Apollo 11 mission, with Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin setting foot on the moon. And as fate would have it, as is my life story, Michael Collins captured into the in the capsule above, never setting foot on the moon. Dr. Roger Lanius is with us. He's a former NASA chief historian, former associate director of the Smithsonian's National Air and Space Museum, and the author of Apollo's Legacy, Perspectives on the Moon Landings. We were talking about John Kennedy's advocacy and his several speeches telling America and fellow politicians why we should go there. And you were saying on the way back from one of the speeches in the limousine, he had some doubts about whether he succeeded in his mission.
He did, exactly. This is the first speech on May 25th of 61. They're going back from the joint session of Congress where he gave the speech back to the White House. And he tells Ted Sorensen, who's his chief speechwriter, you know, I'm not sure Congress is going to go along with this. You know, their reaction was not, you know, arousing applause, a standing ovation, or anything like that. And that was true. But Sorensen sort of said, Mr. President, you don't need to worry. The Vice President, Lyndon Johnson, has got Congress under control. And he did. There was no question at all that the budget, which was the critical item for moving forward with this, was passed with overwhelming support for the next year, and Congress was willing to support it actually throughout, although there were attacks from various sectors in the Congress each year on that NASA budget, thinking it, you know, should be curtailed.
There have always been people on both sides of this question, people who are enthusiastic about this, saying that we absolutely ought to be involved in space for many, many, many different reasons, and people saying on the other side, it's a waste of time. In fact, some people refer to it as a moondoggle.
Right.
And yet, the people who often say that America is the greatest nation in the world look to the moon landings and the space program and our high technology that came out of it as one of the reasons we are the greatest nation in the world, because we're a nation that can do anything if we just put our mind to it. So were the people who were against this, were they on one side of the aisle or on both sides of the aisle?
No, they were actually on both sides. There were liberal Democrats who thought, even though it's a Democratic president, who thought, you know, we can spend that money better elsewhere. And this especially becomes the case during the latter half of the 1960s, after Lyndon Johnson, by this time who's president, announces his Great Society efforts to deal with things like, put in place Medicare and other kinds of social programs. And they thought that money could be better spent for those kinds of purposes. People on the political right thought it was a waste of money because they thought that money could be better spent, you know, on the military, directly confronting the Soviet Union, or perhaps given back as a tax cut. So you find them on both sides, and they are never a majority of people in Congress, but there is a significant and vocal minority, especially over time, arguing for, you know, we can't necessarily do all the things we'd like to do. This is the one that may be of lesser priority than some of the others.
How much of the dissension evaporated after the first moon landing, or did it evaporate at all? Did it just continue on?
Well, clearly, it's continued on at some level, but with the success of the moon landings, everybody's very proud of that, regardless of whether or not you thought it was something you could have expended that money on otherwise, in a different way. But you're clearly proud. A person like Walter Mondale, for instance, who was a vocal critic of the program as a waste of money, even after the fact, you know, at the time of it, says, you know, I'm very proud of what we've accomplished here, and this is a great shining moment for America. I just wish we had spent this money in a different way.
Mm-hmm.
And that was true on the political right as well.
Kennedy thought, for whatever reason, since we were behind the Soviet Union in the space race, he thought this was a race we could win. This putting a man on the moon is something that we could beat them at. And we accomplished the moon landing 8 years and 2 months after he made that speech about going to the moon before the end of the decade. Given the complexity of the task and the fact that we were behind the Russians and the state of technology at the time, and we were just beginning the transistor revolution. Everything up to that point had been vacuum tubes. How did we do it?
Well, obviously, you know, you put a fair measure of public treasury against the problem, and it can go a long way toward helping do it. But there's also a very industrious, very smart, very dedicated group of people, hundreds of thousands of them, actually, who made it possible.
Yeah, I think 400, I think it created 400,000 jobs,
right?
The space program.
Yeah, it did. At the height of Apollo, there were more than 400,000 people working either at NASA as civil servants or as contractors directly supporting the moon program. And so that's a sizable amount of brain power and obviously an investment of dollars to make that possible. But and they were single-mindedly focused on that. There's a great story from the 1960s in which somebody was doing research on identification with jobs and was going to various organizations and asking people, okay, what is your job? And they would say, well, I'm an accountant and I'm balancing the books on this or that, or I'm you know, doing a repair on this particular wall or whatever it happened to be they were doing. They identified it with that particular thing. They go to NASA and they talk to a lot of people. But one of the people that they talked to was a person who was mowing the lawn down at what is now the Johnson Space Center. And he says, what are you doing? And he says, I'm helping us get to the moon. So this devotion to the mission is something that was very present at NASA. Regardless of whether your job was directly supporting that or not, you were helping us get to the moon.
But I want to get back to the technology and how we did it, because I remember watching Neil Armstrong step off the lunar lander ladder and onto the surface of the moon. It was a very, very, very grainy, blurry, black and white picture coming from the moon's surface on a camera that was probably not much better than the actual picture it was transmitting, and thinking, wow, we're actually seeing a picture live from the moon. And I forgave the fuzziness of it. But then I watched the CBS News retrospective of the 50th anniversary the other night, and Walter Cronkite was just as blurry as the moon. So our technology has improved so much just in land-based television in the last 50 years. How did we do it? We keep hearing that we have more computer power in the phones we carry around in our pockets than the Apollo mission had on board the spacecraft and at mission control. If that's true, why didn't it crash?
Well, just because you don't have the same technology you have today doesn't mean you can't do really great, stupendous things. I mean, they had a fair measure of technology, and they had to do things in a different way than we would do them today, because they didn't have, say, that computing power that we have at this point in time. But, you know, all of the technologies that were necessary for Apollo were at least understood what was going to be required, even if they didn't have them. You know, take the Saturn V rocket, the biggest rocket ever built, 363 feet tall, delivered 7.5 million pounds of thrust at launch. I mean, it was stupendous in terms of this particular rocket. They had nothing like that when they got the mission to go to the moon. But they did have rockets, so they understood how those worked. Now they had to scale them up, make them more reliable, and do the things that were necessary to build something big enough to take an astronaut crew to the moon.
Well, we did it in 8 years, but in those 8 years, we went from the Mercury program, which had a tiny capsule with one astronaut, to the Gemini program, which was a bigger capsule with two astronauts, to the Apollo program with three astronauts and eventually a lunar landing module attached to the front of it. Mm-hmm. That seemed the planning of that progression of the series of flights in each of those programs toward Apollo 11, that today would take 8 years to plan.
Well, yeah, I mean, we've jokingly said that if NASA got a mission of a similar nature today, they'd spend as much time planning it as all of Apollo took. Yes, absolutely. And bureaucracy is what it is, and it tends to expand over time. So that's one of the things that happened. You had the virtue of a brand new agency that did not have very much bureaucracy in the early 1960s, and there was a bit more freedom, I think, to make decisions that might have been something wouldn't be tolerated by the powers that be today. You also had, and this is, I think, something remarkable, you had a bunch of people who were sort of very young. The leaders of the agency were, most of them, in their 40s. And the rank and file who were engaged in developing the technology were fairly newly minted engineers and scientists. And in fact, Gene Kranz is famous for having said, and Gene was a mission controller at the time, he says, "We were all young. We didn't know. We weren't supposed to be able to do this."
That is the benefit of youth, I think. Dr. Roger Lonius is with us. He's a former NASA chief historian, former associate director of the Smithsonian's National Air and Space Museum, and the author of Apollo's Legacy, Perspectives on the Moon Landings. No one at that point in 1969 had ever landed on the moon. No one had ever created a lunar landing vehicle up until, I guess, the Mercury program. No one had ever created a space suit. How confident were NASA space flight engineers that this would actually work? And had it not worked, had those men either crashed onto the lunar surface and died, or been unable to get off because there was only one thruster in the lunar landing module ascent vehicle, if it had not gone on, and the switch was broken on it, the on and off switch was broken on it. So if they had not been able to get off the surface, what would have happened to the NASA program?
Well, I mean, it's a amazing question to ask, and fortunately we're not faced with those particular tragedies. But the program was designed in a way that you could do sort of a stepwise set of efforts, and each mission was more sophisticated than the one before it. And there was a real sense that they might have to abort Apollo 11, even to the point where they got the mission in the on its way to the moon. They thought, well, maybe they won't be able to land, and they would abort the mission and come home. If that were the case, then Apollo 12 would be the first lander. If you lose a crew on the moon, and there was real fear that that could happen, you would have certainly been faced with the challenge of carrying on in the aftermath of that. Would you have politically been willing to accept the loss of the astronauts on Apollo 11 and then move on, or would you have killed the program? Fortunately, we were never faced with that particular question. But the result is that that they probably would have said this is still important, because they did have a failure in January of 1967 in which three astronauts were killed, and they. Yeah. It did put them behind schedule. They had to come back from that. But they didn't stop the program at that point. And I think there would be reason to believe they would have carried on even had they lost a crew in flight.
This captured these programs, this space program, and then, of course, the moon programs, captured the imagination not just of American citizens but of the world. That night of July 21st, 1969, when Neil Armstrong stepped onto the surface of the moon, it was watched by almost the entire world in real time. People stayed up all night in parts of the world to see this. And in the United States, there was great public support for a long time for the space program that diminished over time with the repeated moon landings and the shuttle flights that kept going up, but that's all they did. They went up, they conducted experiments behind the scenes that didn't get a lot of publicity and didn't get a lot of enthusiasm. And so we just got bored with it over time. And I'm just curious, all of this happened at a time when there were three networks, when we all watched the evening news on one of these three networks. And the cheerleader of NASA on all these networks is Walter Cronkite from CBS News. He was the most trusted man in America, literally and figuratively. How big a role did his enthusiasm, his support, his personal relationships with the astronauts and people running NASA play in making, in generating support for this?
Oh, I don't think it was any question that it was significant. I mean, Walter Cronkite was a fan of spaceflight from the very earliest days. And some of that may have been as simple as some people have said, you know, if you've got a fire, you want to get TV cameras there because that's great journalism, and it's very dramatic and interesting to the viewers. Well, what could be better than that other than a rocket launch, which is also fire but totally controlled, and in that sense, you find people attracted to it, and Walter Cronkite was. But then, the whole sense of stepping off this planet, of going to another body in the solar system, I mean, that is epic, and it is a signal that that humanity's trajectory has now changed. And Walter Cronkite understood that maybe better than anybody. I mean, he talked about how our descendants, looking back at Earth 200, 300 years from now on the moon or Mars or wherever it happens to be, will think of the 20th century as a time in which we first left this planet to become a multi-planetary species and to move beyond. And it's a remarkable experience. It's similar to the first humans who traveled across the Pacific to populate the islands of the seas, and that is an epical event.
I have less than a minute left in this segment. I'm just curious. We're thinking about going to Mars now. It's hard to express to today's people who were not alive during the moon flights exactly how exciting this was and exactly how enthusiastic a lot of people were and what it meant to the future of mankind. Do you detect any of that when we talk about going to Mars?
Well, I think we will at the time that a program is really being pursued and activities are starting to take place. I mean, when the first tentative flights into space took place, there was excitement about them. Mm-hmm. But before that, when people were talking about it in the 1950s, there might have been some folks who were sort of jazzed by the idea, but they thought it was something that would happen in the distant future. And I think that's how most people look at this going to Mars today.
It took the event to make people really, really excited. We're coming right back with Dr. Roger Launius in a moment at Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. WFAE Charlotte Talks is hosting a public conversation to explore what can be done about the city's rising number of homicides. Only halfway through the year, Charlotte has already surpassed 2018's total. CMPD says this problem can't be law enforcement's alone to address, and they need your help. We examine the factors behind our homicide problem and what community leaders are doing to find solutions. Join us Tuesday, July 30th at Friendship Missionary Baptist Church at 7:30 for this important conversation. More at WFAE.org. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Dr. Roger Launius is with us. He's the author of Apollo's Legacy, Perspectives on the Moon Landings, but he's also the former NASA chief historian and the former associate director of the Smithsonian's National Air and Space Museum. And we're talking, of course, about the 50th anniversary of the flight of Apollo 11, which took off on Tuesday of this week, 50 years ago, and landed on Saturday of this week, 50 years ago, on the surface of the moon, with the moonwalk happening the very next day, with the first man on the moon setting foot on the lunar surface being Neil Armstrong, followed closely behind by Buzz Aldrin. Let's talk about what we got out of this. Manned space flights gave scientists opportunities to run any number of experiments in gravity-free environments. But the biggest experiment of all, the biggest one of Apollo 11, that is, was just to get there, just to get to the moon and land and then come home. It wasn't really even to discover anything special about the moon itself. And you say that they chose the area of the moon called the Sea of Tranquility in which to land a big, flat lunar plain without much differentiation, probably, quote, the least interesting place you could go. Did we do that for safety purposes?
Oh, absolutely. There's always a debate between scientists and engineers at NASA over these kinds of questions. You know, the engineer wants to to minimize the risk as much as possible, whether it be the technologies that are used on the spacecraft or a location for landing. And so they want a big, nice, flat surface where you can land. To the scientists, a big, flat surface where you can land is not very interesting geologically. You want to be near mountains. And so you debate this sort of stuff. So the first landing was really one that was, okay, can we do it? And they were able to pull that off, obviously. The next mission was one in which they landed very close to a Surveyor soft lander that had been on the surface of the moon for more than 2 years, and they wanted to go over and take pieces of it off, and they did that. But progressively, they became more and more, as they got more experience, they became more aggressive in where they could go, and the last few missions were able to get closer to geologically interesting sites.
And but even in that first mission, they did bring back moon rocks.
Absolutely.
What did we learn from those moon rocks? What did we learn about the moon? What did we learn about the solar system? What did we learn?
Yeah, the core issue with the rocks, but it's not just the rocks. It's all the other experiments that were a part of this and the data that came from those, was to give us a pretty good picture of the formation of the moon, which also tells us a fair amount about the formation of the rest of the solar system. And nobody recognized this before. You could fight over, as scientists, what the origins of the moon was and where it came from, but without any real data like those rocks or like other experiments that went to the moon offered, you could argue basically in the dark. They found fairly conclusive proof that the moon was formed when a large body hit the Earth in the primordial era, pushing up stuff from both Earth and this body that formed the moon. So it's different from the Earth, but like the Earth in some ways.
That's hard for a lot of people to understand. I don't understand how that could possibly have happened, because the Earth is a sphere. The moon mm-hmm. is a sphere. So if they...
Right.
Did a sphere-shaped piece of land get chunked out of the Earth, and we just that's where the oceans are? But how do we know this?
Well, the best evidence, and yeah, it wasn't a sphere-shaped part of the Earth that made the moon. It's rubble that all comes together through gravity over a period of time. That's why all the planets, all the bodies that are out there have sort of a spherical shape to them, is that they tend to coalesce around a gravitational force, and that's what happens, and that's what happened with the moon.
So let's talk about what else we got out of this, out of space exploration, out of these moon missions, and our numerous moon landings, other than Tang. let's start.
Which actually was not a product of the moon program, but was a product already available that NASA did adopt.
So let's start with what we discovered from the moon and move on to technology. How is life different or better, or our knowledge deeper or wider than it was than it would have been in the absence of all of this?
Well, okay, first and foremost, and this is data that probably doesn't change the way people live their lives, but our knowledge of the cosmos was exponentially changed because of the moon program and what we learned about the moon, its origins, the solar system, and so on and so forth. We also then learned technologically how to do all kinds of things we could not do before, and those have fundamentally changed our lives. I mean, the kind of knowledge gained in Apollo helped us to pursue satellites in Earth orbit that are doing things on our lives today, like communication satellites, and that they sort of grow up together and feed off of each other in terms of knowledge gained. But that technology has altered the human existence.
The navigation system in your car is a direct result. We couldn't do that without the space program. We couldn't do that without satellites.
Absolutely. The same is true with global instantaneous telecommunications. How can we live without being able to watch in real time the World Cup, and regardless of where it is? And you couldn't do that in the 1960s.
Right. And there are many, many other things that have come
right.
out of this that people... But the big question with that is, wouldn't that have happened eventually anyway?
Perhaps. But we can never know that. It might have happened in a different way. And it certainly wouldn't have happened on the schedule that it did.
So this advanced things. It made it accelerated things that
right.
because of the need. By the time Apollo 11 made it to the moon, NASA's budget had already reached its zenith and was on its way down. That's what
right.
I read yesterday. That's true?
That's true. The NASA budget peaked in 1965, so, you know, 4 years before the first moon landing, it had already peaked, and it was heading down on what looked like a roller coaster ride, and it bottoms out in the mid-70s.
So how much did it cost us to send those first two men to the moon?
Well, the first two men's hard to come up with. The program itself is a little easier.
Okay.
The entire Apollo program cost $25.4 billion in 1960s dollars.
Which is somewhere around 200. I'm sorry. Say it again. Okay, 200 billion. Go ahead. So that seems like a drop in the bucket. I mean, it all adds up over time, but
right.
$200 billion in today's dollars, we spend that much when we sneeze.
Well, it's clearly we spend enormous amounts of money on all kinds of things. You know, the entire NASA budget is less than what people spend on Super Bowl parties each year. So that gives you a sense today of proportion.
So, I mean, I know there are lots of things tugging at the sleeves of the budget makers in Congress for money. Money for this, money for that, and it all adds up, and you do have to set priorities. But when you're talking about $25 billion in 1960, which is $400 billion today, and we have trillions of dollars in debt that mounts every single day, and we spend $400 billion or more on the military, a lot more on the military budget. I think it's
right.
one tiny percentage of the military budget.
Right.
It's hard to understand why people are fixated on how much money we spent. Have we commensurately gotten money out of the program through the 400,000 jobs that it took to put people on the moon, toward the technology that was developed for that has now spread into the private sector and into our homes and into our lives? Has it increased the economy at all over time?
Absolutely. You know, if it had been three times the amount that we spent on Apollo in then-year dollars or current-year dollars, it would have still been worth it in all kinds of ways. The technology that emerged from this was a very real shot in the arm to our larger technological development at the time. A story I like to tell is about the Apollo guidance computer, and we all have heard the stories about you have more power in your cell phone than they had in that computer, and that's all true. But, you know, at the time that NASA's undertaking the moon program, those kinds of technologies did not exist really anywhere, and they had to be pushed. And we needed a computer, a guidance computer that could fit in the spacecraft that was a certain size and shape and had a certain capability. And NASA gave a contract to the Draper Lab at MIT to develop that computer. And the lab hired then 500 or so of the best people they could find to work on this problem, and they put their head down and they built a computer that was of the size and shape and capability that NASA asked for. And it worked beautifully, but it was still very unsophisticated from our standpoint.
Sure.
But the reality was, at the end of the program, the contract ends, the people who had been building that computer left to go other places, and they left with the knowledge they had gained from that process and their Rolodexes, their contact list of all the people they had worked with. And they went to industry, they went to universities, they went to think tanks, and they seeded the microelectronics industry of the 1970s. And I would contend that was an enormous shot in the arm to
people,
the revolution in technology that really takes place that leads to those first personal computers and all the other things that we think of in the 1970s.
People have to understand that in 1961, if there was a computer, it filled rooms. There were enormous boxes that filled a room or two, and the rooms had to be super cooled because they ran so hot, because most of the computers were vacuum tube with big data storage devices on them. And to put a computer in a space capsule smaller than the size of the inside of your car was an enormous achievement. Enormous.
Right.
We have today several private players trying to enter the space program on their own. Jeff Bezos and Elon Musk and others. Is that a good thing?
Oh, absolutely. The more the merrier, in my mind. These individuals who have their own fortunes are willing to spend some percentage of their fortunes to try to advance space exploration. And some of them are also, they're children of Apollo as well. They watched this as kids, and they are excited by what they saw, and they want to see it furthered. And so that's all great. And they built their own rockets, and they're engaged in activities supporting NASA in low Earth orbit, and perhaps in the future they will support efforts to go back to the moon.
Getting back to Apollo 11, the crew consisted of Neil Armstrong, who was a civilian, Buzz Aldrin, who had a military background, and both of whom walked on the moon, and Michael Collins, who stayed in the Apollo capsule and orbited the moon. How did they come to be chosen for this first moon landing mission, and how was Neil Armstrong chosen to be the first human being to set foot on the moon?
Well, in the case of Neil Armstrong, he was the perfect choice to command that mission. He was sort of the astronaut's astronaut. He was very, very cool as a pilot. He demonstrated that over and over again. He had really sort of earned his spurs in the Gemini program, in which he flew a mission that very nearly had a disastrous ending, and he was able to salvage it. And he had a leadership skill that was allowed him to work with pretty much anybody of any personality, and also to sort of keep them under control, which was really important with Buzz Aldrin, who was flamboyant and boisterous and opinionated and all of those things, but also exceptionally studious and really good at supporting efforts like the rendezvous and docking. He was involved in how do you learn how to do that, and in spacewalking. He was one of the first astronauts to go into a swimming pool in a spacesuit to figure out how do you maneuver in space in a weightless environment to do useful things. Very, very talented, but also a personality that was mercurial at best. And then you have Mike Collins, your namesake, who was studious and thoughtful and funny, who probably had the hardest job. He had to stay up in that capsule all by himself. One of the few guys, and he reminded people of that at Mission Control, one of the few guys who didn't get to watch it on television.
Did he ever complain about that?
Jokingly. You know.
Yeah, but the root of all humor is truth.
he says, at the time he sort of quipped. He says, I'm delighted to be on this mission. Is it the best job on this mission? Maybe not, but I'm still on the mission.
We've lost a lot of institutional memory because of nobody today at NASA was part of the mission control or the engineering team that put together the Apollo program, and we want to go to Mars now. They say we want to go to Mars.
Mm-hmm.
We don't necessarily have the leadership. We have a cultural difference in the country that didn't exist back then. We have a more intolerance for risk, it seems, today. Can we do this? Could we go to Mars? Can we muster the unity that's required to do it?
Well, the core question is, do we have the political will? I think it's totally within the capability of NASA and its scientific and technical expertise to accomplish these things. And it can do them. And what will happen if we have the mandate, if there are people who are in positions who are too risk averse or are not willing to accept some of the decisions, they'll replace them with other people.
Dr. Richard Lanius is a former NASA chief historian, former associate director of the Smithsonian's National Air and Space Museum, and the author of Apollo's Legacy, Perspectives on the Moon Landings. Thank you so much for sharing the 50th anniversary with us. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.